The headlines this hour: thousands of people are displaced in Afghanistan's northern province of Kunduz as fighting continues between government forces and Taliban militants. More than 10 million people are placed under fresh COVID-19 restrictions and a curfew in the Thai capital as the country faces a surge of infections. And Israel freezes nearly $200 million in tax transfers to the Palestinian Authority, a move that's slammed by Palestinians as a crime and piracy. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Afghan officials say that thousands of people have been displaced amid raging clashes between government and Taliban forces in Kunduz province.
As the honorable people of Afghanistan are aware, in the last 3 months, as a result of the wars in the Kunduz province, more than 12,000 families have been displaced from their homes, and we identified more than 6,000 of these families who deserved help.
The families displaced by the conflict in Kunduz city say that they are in dire need of food and other aid supplies. Taliban militants have already seized control of most districts in Kunduz province, but are facing resistance from government forces and armed civilians in and around the provincial capital. The militants have made a fresh push to gain more territory in recent weeks. The group says that they are currently in control of over 85% of the Afghan soil. The government, however, denies the claim as propaganda. Amin Alami is our correspondent, joining us from Afghanistan's capital, Kabul, to give us the latest. Well, I mean, there's a lot going on in Afghanistan. Tell us what you have for us.
As you said, thousands of Afghan locals have been displaced inside Afghanistan, mainly in northern parts of this country, due to the rising violence and battles between Afghan security forces and the Taliban militants. But this is not only Kunduz province. Thousands of its residents have been displaced inside Afghanistan. Many other areas are also witnessing the same issue. For instance, hundreds of families have also been displaced from Ghazni city, the capital of Ghazni province in southern Afghanistan. For instance, one of my own relatives, who is an army officer, is currently in Kabul, and I am hosting him and his family with three or four children. The bitter truth is that the war and fightings between Afghan security forces and the Taliban has had very disruptive impacts on the morale of children and women across this country. But let's not forget that according to confirmed reports by Afghan officials in northern Kunduz province of Afghanistan and southern Ghazni city, the Taliban have taken control over many key areas and districts of these two strategic areas in northern and southern parts of Afghanistan. They also the Afghan military officials blame the Taliban for misusing civilians and their houses as shields against Afghan security and defense forces attacks in order to resist against these forces. In the meantime, Afghan security forces say that they are committed to take back the control of the lost areas, mainly key districts in southern, central, northern, and eastern parts of this country.
What are we looking at in terms of the way that that the Taliban is spreading and trying to take control of Afghanistan? I mean, what kind of things, based on the movements that they have across the country, do you foresee them as being their next moves?
Of course, the Taliban currently says that it has control over 85% of Afghan territory, but this claim has been rejected by Afghan officials. The Afghan presidential palace named it a propaganda by the Taliban and said that the Taliban has not enough capability to control those captured areas. And the Afghan officials also say that Afghan security forces are planning to launch a wide-scale military operations or counterattack operations against the Taliban militants in order to take back the control of the many areas that have fallen into the Taliban over the past months. The Taliban increased their attacks, mainly attacks on key districts and centers of some key areas since May. And along with the expansion of Taliban attacks across Afghanistan, we witnessed that armed public fronts also were formed, and they are resisting across many parts of Afghanistan against the Taliban. In some cases, these armed public fronts have retaken the control of some provinces, especially in northern Afghanistan. Saripul province and Faryab, both of them are located in northern parts of Afghanistan, where have witnessed heavy battles between Afghan forces and Taliban militants. But another fact is that many have blamed top military commanders for not ordering Afghan security forces to resist against the Taliban militants in many cases. But the Afghan President Mohammad Ashraf Ghani rejected such claim also, and said that Afghan security forces will not surrender to the Taliban. And this is because they now have the support of public uprising fronts all over this country.
Thank you for that. We appreciate it. Amin Alami from Kabul. On to Thailand. Fresh coronavirus restrictions have come into effect in the capital and its surrounding provinces to contain a new surge of the pandemic. More than 10 million people have been placed under a curfew in Bangkok, the epicenter of the outbreak. The two-week restrictions, toughest in more than a year, also include mall closures and a five-person limit on gatherings. Authorities have also set up 145 checkpoints in high-risk provinces, with 88 of them only in Bangkok, to curb non-essential regional travel. Meanwhile, authorities have reported more than 8,600 new daily cases and 80 deaths. Thailand has been grappling with a new wave of the pandemic blamed on highly contagious strains of the virus and a slow vaccination drive. Australia's New South Wales reports 112 locally acquired cases of COVID-19. That's its biggest daily rise for this year. The surge marks the fifth consecutive day of record case numbers. Almost all the cases were reported in the state capital, Sydney, where lockdown has been in place since 3 weeks ago. Restrictions in Sydney were tightened during the weekend, limiting the gatherings and banning browsing at the shops. Authorities say that lockdown measures could be extended beyond their planned end date of July 16th. Australia has so far been successful in suppressing sporadic outbreaks. However, the highly transmissible Delta strain and a sluggish vaccine rollout have raised concerns of a significant outbreak this time. Only 11% of the country's adults have so far been vaccinated against the disease. The Palestinian Commission for Detainees Affairs has slammed Israel for freezing nearly $200 million in Palestinian tax money. Head of the commission, Qatri Abu Bakr, said the Israeli move is a crime and piracy against Palestinians' funds. The regime claimed Sunday that the funds it froze equal the amount of money the Palestinian Authority paid to families of Palestinians allegedly involved in anti-Israeli attacks. Israel frequently withholds tax money to pressure the cash-strapped authority. The Israeli move means Palestinian employees in the occupied West Bank are almost never paid their wages fully at the end of each month. Media reports suggest a convoy of U.S. military vehicles carrying weapons and other military equipment has arrived in Syria's northeastern province of Hasaka. According to Syria's national news agency, Sana'a, the convoy entered the Syrian territory illegally through the Iraqi border. Reports also say the convoy, which comprises of 48 trucks and other vehicles, was heading toward the U.S. bases in the province. This came days after a similar convoy of 40 vehicles entered the region in line with U.S. plans to boost its presence there. The U.S. has not obtained Syria's permission to deploy troops in the Arab country. Damascus says the American military presence is aimed at plundering the nation's resources and reinforcing Washington's foothold in the country. The European Union's foreign policy chief has expressed regret over comments made by the Slovenian prime minister at an anti-Iran meeting of the MKO terrorist group. Josep Borrell said remarks by Janez Janša to not reflect the EU's position on its relations with Iran. Borrell underlined that the Slovenian premier, whose country holds the rotating presidency of the bloc, did not make the remarks in his capacity as the leader of an EU member state. Borrell made the comments in a phone conversation with the Iranian foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif. Meanwhile, the Iranian foreign ministry summoned the Slovenian ambassador to Tehran and conveyed to him Tehran's strong protests over the issue. Iran has demanded an immediate explanation from the Slovenian government in that regard. The participation of former and current Western officials in the annual summit of anti-Iran terror group Mojahedin Khalq organization has sparked a wave of reactions on social media platforms. Hashtag trending is next with a quick review of some of those comments.
everyone, and welcome back to another Hashtag Trending with me, Ali Reza. 2 days after the annual meeting of the notorious anti-Iran terrorist group, the Mujahideen Khalq organization, or the MKO, social media is still filled with tweets and comments about the attendees in the summit. Many say that the participants, like, for example, the former U.S. Undersecretary of Defense or the Slovenian Prime Minister, risk their reputation merely for the fat stacks of cash they received for participating. When it comes to the issue of terrorism, the West shows a history of double standards in dealing with it. In the latest sign of Western double standards, a number of former and current Western officials participated in the annual summit of MKO, the terrorist group responsible for thousands of targeted assassinations in Iran. The Western officials' participation in the MKO conference was mainly for two reasons. Many of them did so for the sake of money, and for others, the terrorist group is their last hope to bring down the Iranian establishment. One of the widely blamed participants in this year's summit was Michel Flournoy, the former U.S. Undersecretary of Defense. Our first tweet of the day comes from Jacob Silverman. He wrote, "I watched Michel Flournoy's MEK or MKO speech, mostly pro-Biden pabulum, but the whole thing is embarrassing, especially for a serious person. She called for internal regime change and said MEK's work was important." Our next tweet comes from Max Blumenthal. He wrote, "Michel Flournoy nearly became Biden's defense secretary and co-founded the West Exit corporate influence peddling firm that sent 15 consultants into Biden's White House. Now she's shilling for the MEK cult that carries out assassinations and destabilizes Iran. Pure sleaze. That's how the U.S. sees terrorism. There are the good terrorists and then there are the bad terrorists." Our next comment comes from Thomas Junot. He wrote, "It's that time of the year when the MEK, a thuggish cult based in Albania with zero support inside Iran, has its annual summit, where well-paid Western politicians show up to pretend they support democracy in Iran." Well, making a quick buck within a few minutes just by reading over an already prepared text? Good job. Our next comment comes from Masoud. He wrote, "Maryam Rajavi's face-saving carnival after being deported from the EU to Albania has proved to be very costly for the new benefactors of Saudi Arabia. American lobbies overcharging them for supporting terrorists. U.S. supporting MEK or MKO terrorists in Albania." Iran has always been outspoken in criticizing the Western support for the terrorist group, which was once blacklisted by both the U.S. and the European Union. Now, some social media users are calling for the prosecution of these Western officials who participated in the MKO summits. Our next comment comes from Harry. He wrote, "Already know this, but just in case, Pompeo, Giuliani, Bolton, etc. are all disgraced Americans who ought to be prosecuted." Nazanin wrote, "Remember always and forever that MEK terrorist activities are the worst sectarian violence Iran has experienced since 1979. Our next tweet comes from Exhausted Surf. They wrote, "Why was it removed from the terrorist list?" The next tweet gives the answer to this. It's a reply by ABCDEF1234. They wrote, "It paid the U.S. government money to be taken off." Calling for freedom in Iran to be achieved by a cult-like group who has the blood of thousands of Iranians on its hands. Now, see, this explains perfectly why the Iranians feel so offended when they see the West's continued and brazen support for the MKO. Our final batch of tweets for the day starts with one by Masoud. He wrote, "MEK or MKO terrorists normally pay handsomely for their events speakers. Past paymasters on the record were Saudi Arabia." Our next comment reads, "Western politicians, including CIA directors, ex-prime ministers, secretaries, senators, for sale. Lying, cheating, stealing Pompeo for free if you buy three or more. Don't have money? Go to Albania. Ask Maryam Rajavi to get it from Saudi Arabia. No problem." Our next comment comes from Dr. Fauci's smirk, probably not Dr. Fauci himself. It reads, "The MEK or MKO is a pretty nasty terrorist outfit, also supported by Trump's Secretary of Defense, backed by Israel. They have a pretty vicious presence on social media." Our final comment by Sajjad Batani reads, "I never understand how Western politicians can stand this cognitive dissonance. believing at the same time in human rights and MEK or MKO scientifically, as Leon Festinger said, they cannot hold these dissonances. They do not believe in human rights, or they are not a human being. Hashtag double standards.
Welcome back. China's military says it drove away a U.S. warship after it entered Chinese waters. The military said the incident took place near the Paracel Islands in the South China Sea. It also called on the U.S. to immediately stop what it called provocative actions. The incident comes amid simmering tensions between the two sides in the area. Earlier, the U.S. Secretary of State warned China against any attack on the Philippine Armed Forces, saying that it would trigger a 1951 mutual defense treaty with the Philippines. Antony Blinken issued the warning on the fifth anniversary of a Hague tribunal ruling against China's territorial claims in the area. On Friday, Beijing reiterated that it does not accept the ruling. Geopolitical analyst Brian Berletech believes the U.S. is using China's disputes with other countries in the South China Sea as a pretext to insert itself into regional relations.
This dispute in the South China Sea is one of many maritime disputes that we see all over the world. Nations have these sort of disputes. And as a matter of fact, in the South China Sea, it's not just China and these other claimants. These other claimants have disputes amongst themselves. So this is the United States trying to insert itself into what are ordinary disputes that could be resolved bilaterally and trying to transform it into a regional, if not international, crisis. And that tribunal that was mentioned, even though it mentioned the Philippines, it was actually brought to The Hague by a team of U.S. lawyers. So this is really the U.S. trying to use the Philippines as a pretext to insert itself into what would otherwise just be ordinary maritime disputes. I think the Philippines have made it very clear that they are unhappy with their relationship with the United States, the way the U.S. is involving itself in its affairs. There are obviously political factions in the Philippines that kind of lean more towards the West. But the reality is the Philippines' economy is dependent on trade with China. The U.S. is saying that these waters are important for international trade. It's China who benefits most from that trade continuing. It's the U.S. who stands the most to benefit by creating a crisis and disrupting the free movement through these waters.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@ irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, a list of good manners. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Brothers and sisters, we talk about akhlaq, we hear about akhlaq, we hear about morals and, you know, divine ethics and so on and so forth. We have tried to compile a quick list for you to be able to read these verses of Quran, ponder, and also try to look at the translation and interpretation of these verses. They are pertaining to us maintaining that Islamic akhlaq. Keep your trust and promises. This is chapter 23, verse 8. Don't insult others' false gods. Chapter 6, verse number 108. Don't deceive people in trade. Number 6, 152. Don't ask unnecessary questions. 5, 101. Sometimes asking questions is good, but a lot of times we end up asking redundant questions without contemplating, without giving it a deeper thought. This is not in line with Islamic akhlaq. Don't be miserly nor extravagant. 2567. We have seen families, we have seen friends who are either extravagant or they are overly miserly. So their own families, in some cases, they end up suffering. This is not, again, in line with Islamic moral conduct. Don't call others with bad names. 4911. Isn't it so common? We have these names that the people don't like and we keep calling them with those names. Don't claim yourselves to be pure. 5332. You know, this self-love, this self-infatuation, this, overconfidence, this is not something Islam has taught us. Nice speakly even to the ignorant. 2563. Don't ask for repayment for favors. 76.9. Welcome back to your listeners. Hope you're benefiting from this series where we have brought to you the consolidated akhlaq and moral conduct that a believer is expected to have. Make room for others at gatherings. Chapter 58, verse number 11. You know, sometimes you're in a gathering, in a majlis, you know, you're listening to a lecture, somebody walks in, you have room around you where you can make good space for that person, but you just are lazy. You don't do it. This is not in line with Islamic akhlaq. If enemy wants peace, then accept it. 861. But be very careful. Sometimes they say that they expect and want peace while they continue to conspire against you. So be very careful of this catch. Return a greeting in a better manner. Somebody says salam to you, say salamun alaikum. Somebody says salamun alaikum, say salamun alaikum wa rahmatullah. Somebody says salamun alaikum wa rahmatullah, say salamun alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You know, you need to respond in a warmer manner. Don't remind others of your favors. Again, you know, it's in chapter 2, 264. We do favors here and there, but then we keep reminding the people that remember that day when I gave you a loan, for instance. This is not in line with Islamic akhlaq. Make peace between fighting groups. Sometimes people, they become a side. Sometimes people, they like two sides fighting and they just, play a role in which they create or continue to create that separation and that confusion between those two groups. Again, this is not Islamic moral conduct. Lower your voice and talk moderately. 31:19. Don't let hatred cause you to be unjust. Last but not the least is be just, even against yourself and relatives. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parsetoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Economic divide.
It is often called the biggest U.S. double standard. The U.S. not only possesses and maintains nuclear weapons, it lectures the world on the threat, like from Iran, on the virtues of nuclear nonproliferation. At the same time, it is upgrading its nuclear arsenal to the tune of between $1 to $2 trillion. Hi, I'm Kavit Afwai. Welcome to this edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, U.S. nuclear weapons upgrade. The development of new U.S. air, land, and sea-based nuclear systems, dubbed the Nuclear Triad, part of the U.S. strategic doctrine. The U.S. says that they must be modernized, but for whom and against what? Meanwhile, the U.S. President Joe Biden has said that it would review the $1.2 trillion nuclear modernization program. He said that he would trim funding for nuclear weapons and will reduce their role in the Pentagon strategy. Also, we will take a look at how the U.S. says its nuclear weapons are for nuclear deterrence, exaggerating threats coming from China, Russia, and Iran, at the same time sanctioning these countries, preventing their economic advancement. Or is that the real aim?
Intercontinental ballistic missiles, strategic nuclear bombers, and submarine-launched ballistic missiles. The U.S. views them as its three pillars in the nuclear policy. The U.S. says that atomic warheads and transport means introduced during the Cold War are falling behind. It claims that they need to be modernized. For that reason, the administration of former U.S. President Barack Obama approved the modernization plans to replace them with the latest ones, to the tune of between $1.2 to $2 trillion over the course of 30 years. Ironic that the former U.S. president was presented as being in a nuclear paradox, pushing for cuts, yet to have agreed to upgrades. At least with Donald Trump, the view was clear.
Three legs of the triad, though, do you have a priority? Because I want to go to Senator Rubio
I think for me, nuclear is just the power, the devastation is very important to me.
It was reported not that long ago that the Biden administration was actually incorporating a new $100 billion nuclear missile system. Now, that was misleading, since this was actually part of the U.S. nuclear upgrade and modernization that was initiated during the Obama years. Now, this is a story in a nutshell. According to a 2019 Congressional Budget Office report, the U.S. is committed to spending about $500 billion, $494 billion to be exact, on its nuclear forces over the next decade. That adds up to be about $50 billion per year. Over the next three decades, nuclear weapons modernization plans could cost as much as between $1.2 or $1.5 to $2 trillion.
The U.S. already directs about 5.5% of its defense budget just toward its nuclear forces. And the cost is expected to rise with the arsenal's modernization needs and could swallow up to 8% of defense spending by the late 2020s.
The current modernization program, to the best we can see, is not sustainable economically. So we'd have to cut some conventional programs and use that on nuclear instead. And that's a huge dilemma inside military planning.
Well, the guest for this segment of the Q&A is Behrad Nahai. He's a nuclear scientist and engineer. He's also a social activist. I'd like to welcome you. Let's take a look at the U.S. claims that the sole purpose of the U.S. nuclear arsenal should actually be deterrence, but it has cited Russia and China as national security threats. This type of nuclear buildup not only initiated a Cold War, but it appears that the U.S. wants to also have leverage on these countries, both politically and economically. Is this how this can be viewed?
Well, answer this correctly, we have to look at the baseline. In the 70s, after opening to China, United States, not the government, the industry, without objection of the government, or probably with the encouragement of government, started to export its industry, the software part of it, to India, because they already knew the language, so they can interact, and the hardware to China, because cheap labor.
It's time for our in-depth section of the program. The theory that nuclear weapons are decreasing in numbers and that there was an end to the Cold War, that no longer holds true. Now, one of the reasons is the U.S. insistence on nuclear weapons, modernization, and nuclear upgrades. Let's first take a look at nuclear stockpiles of other countries. We're going to go back to the year 2013 in order to do that and take a look at Russia, for example, at that time. 8,500 nuclear weapons it possessed. The U.S. had 7,700. This includes deployed and reserved warheads. Now, China at the time had 250 nuclear warheads. Now, fast forward to the year 2020. You can see that the number of nuclear warheads, weapons, is decreasing. As of the end of that year, the number for the U.S., for example, stood at 5,800. Russia, it stood at 6,375. So there was a decrease. But notice China. Now, China, that increased its nuclear warheads. It was 250 to 320. From China's point of view, since the U.S. sees it as a national security threat, it has increased its military capabilities, of which nuclear weapons is part of its program. Now, the former U.S. President Donald Trump, who was not the first U.S. president to go after the expansion of U.S. nuclear arsenal, certainly glorified the building and the expansion of nuclear weapons.
I think we can do a lot of things militarily also. For instance, they're making a lot of weapons, tremendous weapons, and so are we. We just had $716 billion approved for military last year. Now we're possibly going to do more this year. And between Russia and China and us, we're all making hundreds of billions of dollars worth of weapons, including nuclear, which is ridiculous. And I would say that China will come along, and I would say Russia will come along. It doesn't really make sense that we're all doing this. I think we're the leader. I think we're always going to be the leader. We have to be the leader. I think it's much better if we all got together and we didn't make these weapons.
Donald Trump for you and his way of explaining things. Well, the U.S. nuclear modernization and upgrade program, however, is in fifth gear. Now, did you know that the U.S. actually has a nuclear strike command? It's called Air Force Global Strike Command. Well, that's appropriate. And it's a major command of the United States Air Force, headquartered at Barksdale Air Force Base, Louisiana. AFGSC provides combat-ready forces to conduct strategic nuclear strikes and global strike operations in support of combatant commanders. And this is their state of mind these days.
The U.S. Air Force's Nuclear Command says it's about to undergo a major reorganization as it prepares to field new bombs, missiles, bombers, and rockets. Air Force Global Strike Command stood up in 2009 as the successor to Strategic Air Command, which maintained around-the-clock nuclear alerts during the Cold War. Today, the command's 34,000 personnel oversee 20 B-2 stealth bombers, 76 B-52 bombers, and 450 Minuteman III intercontinental ballistic missiles, together capable of delivering thousands of nuclear warheads.
Yeah, this type of stuff really boggles the mind. All right, and when you thought it couldn't get worse, it actually does. The U.S. is actually getting this. It's a $100 billion nuclear weapon. A new weapon of mass destruction. A nuclear missile that's the length of a bowling lane. It's going to be able to travel some 6,000 miles. It's going to carry a warhead, or it can carry a warhead, more than 20 times more powerful than the atomic bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima. It will be able to kill hundreds of thousands of people in a single shot. The U.S. Air Force plans to order more than 600 of them.
Close your door. Open.
America is building a new weapon of mass destruction, a nuclear missile the length of a bowling lane. It will be able to travel some 6,000 miles, carrying a warhead more than 20 times more powerful than the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. It will be able to kill hundreds of thousands of people in a single shot. The U.S. Air Force plans to order more than 600 of them.
Yeah, go figure that out. 600 at $100 billion for each. Okay, another case for alarm. We've said so many of them. Well, that's the U.S. nuclear weapons stockpile around the world, the secret U.S. nuke locations. Not so secret, obviously, we know where the locations are in terms of the countries anyways. We've got their positioned around the world. We've got the Netherlands, Belgium. Italy has two locations where you have these nuclear warheads, Germany and Turkey. In terms of the total nuclear, I guess, warheads that's in these different locations, which includes B-61 nuclear weapons, they're roughly about 150. And what is ironic about this whole nuclear affair is where the money can be spent in the U.S. I mean, if you think about it, can't the U.S. government spend the money on, for example, hunger? Take a look at this chart over here. You're looking at the U.S. military spending as a whole, roughly looking at about $700 to $800 billion.
okay? Out of that, you're looking at about $50 billion for nuclear weapons, which some say that could, is going to increase monumentally. It could go up to $100 billion. That's yearly. That's also per year, the nuclear or the military spending. Now here, you have food assistance. In the U.S., between 30 to 40 million Americans need assistance for food. They don't have enough money for food. The money runs out for families. Don't you think that, which amounts to about $70 to $80 billion that the U.S. government actually dishes out for that, don't you think that out of all this money, which in total is $700 to $800 billion for U.S. military spending, that $70 or $80 billion could be spent on helping Americans who are hungry? That is the key question over here. And in terms of the total number of people who are on this, as I mentioned, it's between 30 to 40 million people. Let's not forget this nuclear spending is something that has a lot of opposition.
My very serious concerns about our nation's bloated military budget, particularly in light of the many unmet needs we face as a nation. Also, I must express a very serious objection to the fact that we are dealing with a $716 billion piece of legislation that is more than half of the discretionary budget, and yet we will, in all likelihood, not have a process which allows for amendments to be debated. $716 billion at a time when in Louisiana, as I understand it, they're now going to be cutting food stamps for hungry children, where schools throughout this country don't have enough money for books or for teachers' salaries. We're talking about a $716 billion military budget, and this process, as I understand it, will allow for no amendments, despite the fact that I think virtually every member of the Senate has concerns about this bill.
Okay. What's incredible about this is the fact that Bernie Sanders, aside from how he clearly describes this scenario, is that there are no amendments, so this is going to get passed. Nobody can argue against the figure for the military spending. Okay, let's bring in Scott Ritter here. He is the former UN Chief Weapons Inspector. He was a critic of the U.S. foreign policy in West Asia and prior to the invasion of Iraq in March 2003. He stated that Iraq possessed no significant weapons of mass destruction. Scott, welcome. The U.S. claims that the sole purpose of the U.S. nuclear arsenal should be deterrence, but it has cited Russia and China as national security threats. This type of nuclear buildup not only initiated a Cold War, based on what many have said, but it appears that the U.S. wants to also have leverage, both politically and economically, over China and Russia. Is this how this can be viewed, do you think?
Well, first of all, I mean, it doesn't do the argument any good to compare nuclear weapons with impoverished Americans. They don't factor into the debate. There's always been starving Americans, and since 1945, America's always had nuclear weapons, and never the two shall meet. So I understand the sentiment, but the same argument could be made for conventional military forces. Why do we spend so much money invading and occupying Iraq? Why do we spend so much money bombing Syria? Why do we spend so much money in a 20-year war in Afghanistan when we have starving Americans?
The U.S. believes that China and Russia want to shape a world consistent with their model, gaining veto over other nations' economic, diplomatic, and security decisions. But the U.S. nuclear modernization and military buildup may have nothing to do with China's military. In other words, it is not China's military that the U.S. sees as a threat, but their economy and their technology. Smartphones come from China. Phone commerce via a messaging app is commonplace. China's home to Huawei, Alibaba, Baidu, Tencent, and Xiaomi. Then comes massive investments in AI and 5G. Just in 5G, China's getting one of the world's largest 5G deployments. 5G is already available in 50 cities in China, and 130,000 5G base stations are about to go live. What's more, China is also home to two-thirds of global investment into artificial intelligence, recently replacing the U.S. And China is projected to take over the U.S. as the number one economy. Which begs the question, how can the U.S. stop China replacing it unless through military force?
When it comes to the nuclear energy industry, not nuclear weapons, the U.S. boasts about how good that is for the economy. The U.S. says that the nuclear industry powers the nation and communities, that it provides enormous economic benefits and is critical to U.S.'s national security, serving as a reliable energy source. Some of the advantages: supports nearly 500,000 jobs in the U.S., contributes an estimated $60 billion to the U.S. gross domestic product each year. Nuclear energy contributes $10 billion in federal taxes yearly, adding $60 billion to the country's GDP. This happened for the year 2018. And on average, a nuclear energy facility generates $470 million in sales of goods and services annually in the local community and $40 million annually in labor income. Okay, let's bring in both of our guests now to see whether their thoughts converge on this or not. Scott Ritter and Behrad Nahai join us. I'm going to first turn to you, Scott. The U.S. not only possesses and maintains around 6,000 nuclear weapons, that's come down roughly, but also boasts an array of weapons of mass destruction, including chemical and biological ones, and yet it lectures the world on the threat from Iran and on the virtues of nuclear non-proliferation. Analysts consider the U.S. position on a nuclear weapons actually a multi-layered cake of highly transparent double standards, one way of describing it. Does the U.S. exercise this manufactured threat to prevent economic and political advancement like in Iran's case?
Look, there can be no doubt that there is a large element of hypocrisy in the American position regarding nuclear weapons. You know, we were one of the nations that pushed for the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And part of the Non-Proliferation Treaty holds that there are five declared nuclear powers and that the world will be limited to these five.
Okay, what do you think, Behrad, of what our guest there said? I mean, do you agree with Scott on U.S. nuclear hypocrisy, as Scott said, and in particular whether the U.S. exercises this manufactured Iran nuclear threat to prevent economic and political advancement, which obviously is being exercised in Iran's case, it appears?
Well, NPT is both a success and a failure. It started at the time that there were no mutual trust between the nations, and the world was bipolar, the communists versus the free world. The communists controlled all the communist countries which fell under the umbrella, and by most, the United States controlled the free world on one side. Under those circumstances, they brought the NPT, hoping that they would prevent other nations develop nuclear weapons in exchange for helping with the peaceful nuclear development, and also with the main promise that they would agree over time reduce to eliminate their nuclear weapons.
That was Behrad talking there. And also Scott Ritter, prior to him, former UN Chief Weapons Inspector, Behrad, a nuclear scientist and engineer. Okay, I'm going to be right back with the Info News section, but first, let's take a look at other countries and their nuclear stockpiles. It's time for our Info News section, where we take a look at other economic news from around the world. Our first stop is China. We're going to take a look at China's yuan. What has occurred? The share of China's yuans of global currency reserves, which are held by global central banks, have reached a new high, that high being 2.45% in the first quarter of 2021. Now, the yuan's previous forex share was 2.2%, That happened in the last quarter of 2020. Comparatively speaking, the greenback's share currently stands at 59.5%, with the euro and the yen far behind, standing at 20.57% and 5.89%, respectively. However, that's an increase on the yuan, so we wanted to point that out. Next, the OPEC oil production. Oil has surged. Prices are incredible. $75 per barrel is the latest that we have on that. It could be up to 76. At least as of the recording of this program, it was at around $75. Reports have emerged that OPEC and its non-OPEC partners like Russia and also Iran were discussing another gradual increase in oil supply of 2 million barrels per day to happen between August and December. Now, as of the recording of this program, OPEC delayed its decision on producing more oil. Next up, U.S. spending. Under the microscope of the IMF, it has issued a statement. It says that the U.S. spending should be prioritized. What areas should it be prioritized into? Well, it says spending should focus on productivity, labor force, and on poverty. So the IMF actually pointing out where the U.S. spending should be. We've talked about military and nuclear weapons also, but will the U.S. listen? I mean, who knows? Maybe it'll listen to the IMF. Finally, a study has come out on world debt. It says that debt could trap low-income nations into poverty. The report said that heavy debt burdens may generate a permanent global divergence between rich and poor countries, that while the international community was likely to help countries facing difficulties on debt resolution, for that to actually be a mechanism in order to reduce the debt. Now, my final thoughts are coming up next. Upgrading and modernizing nuclear weapons requires massive spending, like the $1 trillion or more that the U.S. is going to be spending over the next 30 years. And to say that one nuclear bomb can destroy the Earth many times over, well, you've heard that before. It's just played out. It's a repeat. To also say that the U.S. can spend this money wisely in other ways, well, that's also played out, but it's worth repeating. I mean, there are around 40 million Americans that require food assistance, aside from the poverty in that country and homelessness. You heard U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders saying how U.S. infrastructure and schools need money. Well, the problem in the U.S. is that military manufacturers, hand-in-hand with the Pentagon, they rule the U.S. political system, including the U.S. president. What other explanations can there be for all the U.S. military bases, the cost involved, the director of covert military engagements around the world, the cost involved there, and most recently how the U.S. alleges there are threats from China and Russia, more reasons to spend money on the military. And finally, comes the U.S. double standard on nuclear weapons. You can't have it, the U.S. says, only I can. And this is most evident in the way that the U.S. has dealt with Iran, preventing Iran from pursuing its civilian nuclear program. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. From Yikova Tahle and the entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.